I'm going to be talking about the consequences of learner evolution. I finished talking about touching, and now I want to talk about the kind of thing that happens for kappa bigger than 8. As you know, for kappa bigger than 8, what we see is a situation in which a whole area of the complex plane gets gobbled up by the process of motion. And since we're talking about the motion of whole areas, it pays to think about this in terms of the formulation of fluid dynamics. Imagine that you have a fluid described by a density, rho of r and t. And the motion of the fluid is described by a current or a flux, j of rt. Then the conservation of the amount of fluid is a statement that d rho dt plus div dot j equals zero. And the current is just the velocity of the fluid at rt times the density at rt. This fluid need not be incompressible. Many of the examples, the fluid is incompressible, but we're talking about compressibility here. I want to interpret this equation as the equation for learner evolution, or this equation in terms of this kind of flow of a density. So I'm going to think of the derivative of h as a velocity. And in fact, the velocity that was determined here is 2 divided by h minus the time derivative of the forcing. And we are going to ask, what is the probability of observing a given value of h? So we'll write h is u plus iv. And forget about the r and t. We will think about this as a coordinate, u and v, as a coordinate, and then we will have a velocity given by the right-hand side of the equation for the coordinate u or the coordinate v. Clearly, the velocity in the u direction is u over u squared plus v squared, since 1 over h, 1 over u plus iv is the velocity is 2 over h, 2 over u plus iv is 2u over u squared plus v squared minus 2iv over u squared plus v squared. We therefore have velocities in the u and v direction, which are given by this. Our trajectory is of the motion that we're visualizing is obtained by taking du dv, which from this equation is minus u over v. And what we are going to see then is a set of trajectories in the h or uv plane in which we see a group of hyperboles which keeps uv is equal to a constant. In fact, we know the speed of the motion along this hyperbole. Since we are doing something without force for the moment, with c dot equals zero for the moment, and then what we see when c dot is equal to zero is that g or h is the same thing squared as u squared plus v squared. But our solution of last time was that that was 4t plus z squared. Z is an initial value, is a constant of the motion. I take the real and the imaginary part of the equation. One piece is that u, the imaginary part is uv is a constant. The real part is u squared minus v squared is equal to 4t plus another constant. So the motion is like this, in which u continually increases in speed. It is v squared plus u continually increases in value. It is equal to v squared plus 4t plus another constant. That's the sort of motion we have. Now, if I wanted to draw a picture of this motion, the picture would look like the following. All of these particles out here are doing, they're hyperbolic thing. Only the particle coming down here at u equals 0 is falling into the origin and then out of the entire system. This set of equations has all the particles, as we know, that fall out of the system lie on a line. If we but changed the sign of one of these velocities, if instead of having the velocity in the u direction being equal to 2u over u squared plus v squared, we had it be minus 2u over u squared plus v squared, keeping the velocity in the v direction fixed. Let me put if in a different color chalk. What we have is the result without that minus sign. If we had a minus sign there to go with this minus sign, then we would have a sink at the origin. And whole areas of particles would fall into that sink. We'd have a motion that looks like that. Whole areas of particles would fall into that sink, and we would get a non-zero area per unit time falling out of the system. As it is, a subset of particles of measure zero fall out of the system in every unit of time. That's what the words on the transparency say, and I'm not going to repeat those words. But now let me imagine that I was doing a slightly different situation. Let me imagine that instead of, and I will go back to G instead of H, and instead of writing instead of having C of T be 0, I go to the opposite limit, in which C of T oscillates back very rapidly, infinitely rapidly, as a function of time between minus 1 and 1. If it visits all points between minus 1 and 1 equally, what we have here instead of what I wrote down is the integral dc from minus 1 to 1, 2 over g minus c, which, I'm sorry, 1 over g minus c, which is then the logarithm of g minus 1 divided by g plus 1. This logarithm then gives us an entirely different pattern of motion from this. This rapid motion back and forth is like what happens for kappa bigger than 8, in which the Brownian motion moves the forcing very rapidly. Here, what we have is a situation which looks like the following. instead of having this happen with the particles veering off at the end, what happens is we have a whole region in which particles could fall between minus 1 and 1. And indeed, as the motion goes on, what happens is that particles in a whole region of the UV plane, now I'm using G as U plus IV, because H is not well defined, a whole region of U plus IV fall out of the system, and in each time more and more particles spread in this initial region fall out of the system. This is like the behavior for kappa bigger than A, and is indicative of what happens when we have very rapid motion of the forcing term. If you think of it for a moment, it's rather surprising and beautiful. You have this forcing, which is moving up and back. As long as the motion is sort of regular, what happens is an occasional particle falls through the forcing. If the motion becomes infinitely rapid, then it can catch particles from a whole area of the plane, and indeed, whole areas of the plane disappear in each unit of time. An amazing change in behavior. That is the end of my first lecture. Questions or comments? I now start on lecture 2, which is more connected with DLA and the dynamics of SLE. Well, it isn't precisely lecture 2. If you look carefully, you see that there's a page number 13 down there. That page number 13 indicates I left some stuff out. This was stuff that was covered beautifully by Schramm, and I'm not going to go back over it. I'm going to start out by telling you what DLA is. It's a model of dynamics that was developed by Tom Witten and Len Sander. The model was intended to construct scale-invariant fractal objects. Notice that I don't use the word conformal invariant. Conformal invariance wasn't in tremendous amount of fashion then, and in fact the results are not conformally invariant objects. This introduces you to a whole different topic, which has to do with how dynamics works in physical situations. DLA describes how tiny bits of soot may come together and form one large aggregate with interesting fractal geometry. It was one of the first models in physics to be initially expressed as a computer algorithm. Since the process of walking that goes into DLA is time-independent diffusion, the probabilities which arise will satisfy the Laplace equation. But first, let me tell you about the model, and then I'll go into the mathematics of it. So now I want to define for you what DLA is. DLA has an aggregate, a group of particles all clumped up together. There's the aggregate. And the aggregate grows step by step. It's going to grow by having a particle start out at infinity, undergo a random walk on this kind of lattice, finally come to a nearest neighbor site to one already occupied. As soon as it comes to a nearest neighbor site to one already occupied, it sticks. It grows the aggregate by one unit, and then what happens is another particle is added at infinity and undergoes the same random walk process until it comes next to the aggregate and grows it further by one unit. This step-by-step process is repeated hundreds or thousands or millions of times and produces beautiful fractal aggregate structures like this one. This particular one, I think, although my record keeping isn't so good, this particular one, I think, is one generated by experimentalists rather than on a computer, but I'm not absolutely sure about that. Okay. The random walk process is described by all random walk processes are described by a discretized version of the diffusion equation. Imagine that we have a random walk process going on here outside of the aggregate, and this goes on a lattice, which is too fine a scale to be shown on this picture. The probability that we could find a walker at the position xy is p of xy. The fact that we have diffusion means that, first of all, del squared p is equal to 0. Secondly, that there is a source of unit strength out at infinity. That's what I mean by adding a particle at infinity. That's a flux condition on an exterior boundary. Because the walk stops as soon as the particle comes next to the aggregate, the probability vanishes on the aggregate. This is sufficient to uniquely define the probability PXY. And the probability of actually landing on the site next, this site here, right next to the aggregate, is the particle's probability of being added at that site here next to the aggregate. This is then the probability of growth at the site. Within the continuum thing that results, in fact, that probability is proportional to the normal derivative of p of xy at that site, the normal derivative having a little trickiness being defined, but works out pretty well. And you can see what happens, not so well from this picture, but better from a picture like this, which was done in the very early days of diffusion limited aggregation by my student Chao Tang. Here we considered a geometry in which there were reflecting walls and an absorbing bottom. Particles were added way up there beyond the top of my finger, and they wandered down until they became a nearest neighbor and added to the aggregate. At the beginning, there were a few bushes that grew, but as time went on, one of these trees took over and dominated the entire channel. This is a typical DLA type of picture in the channel geometry. Questions, comments? Now, the way the talk was originally set up, I was talking not only about DLA, but about lots of other problems. So I want to describe invariance properties and the invariance properties of the critical phenomena problems that I was talking about, as well as of the DLA, involves translational invariance. You can pick the whole thing up and move it to someplace. Rotational invariance, no direction is picked out in space except by the lattice, and if you look at the picture, it doesn't appear that the lattice redefines itself in the picture. The lattice falls out of the result, apparently. There's a parity invariance that x goes into x and y goes into minus y is a good invariance of the property of the problem. There is a scale invariance, that is, if you look at what goes on with different magnifications, you see the same thing. And there is a kind of boost operation, a conformal boost, in which r goes into 1 over r where R goes into R divided by R squared. These operations all together are the invariance properties of most of the two-dimensional problems we're talking about. Exactly how these work themselves out in the DLA is somewhat tricky, and in fact it is a present belief that the scale invariance is tricky and the conformal invariance is false for the object being produced. Now I want to make contact between the DLA and mapping problems. We approach the learner evolution as we have many times through WDT, that's G, is 2 over W minus a forcing, and its solution, W, is a function of time and the initial value Z. In writing the solution, we've translated our problem from finding one trajectory, G of T, for a particular value of Z, to finding many different trajectories parameterized by the initial data Z. And this is a point of view, this change in point of view is a change of point of view taken by a modern differential equation theory in which one thinks of whole collections of orbits together and entire planes of behavior instead of an individual orbit. Let's approach this problem more generally than just in doing learner evolution. Let's imagine an equation of motion, dw dt is w, and it's a function v of w and t. With the initial data, w is equal to z at some initial time t0. The solution can be written down as w is g, which depends on t0 and t. G can then be thought of as a map from the initial conditions to a set of later values W. Iterated function theory enters naturally in every dynamical system. Every analysis of a time derivative of this form, because if you calculate the solution in two pieces, you go from T0 to T1 and from T1 to T, you first perform one mapping operation, and then another, and then you compose the two. That is, the final result is always independent of the form of the differential equation. W is a function g, which depends on the intermediate time, and the function g, which depends on the initial time, and the value of z, which gives the initial position. In this talk, g, w, and z have all been complex variables, and g, as expressed as a function of g, has been an analytic function. So the iterated function theory is a very natural tool for discussing Lerner's evolution equation. In caudal Lerner evolution, g of t0 and t is a conformal map from the upper half plane to the, In caudal Lerner evolution, g of t is a conformal map to the, from a subset of the upper half plane to the entire upper half plane. The most important property of such mappings is their composition rule, and I have a picture which describes the composition rule. So you start out with one thing which takes you from a subset, the subset above the blue line, of the upper half plane to the entire upper half plane, another that takes you to another subset. You put the two together and you get a larger set which is removed from the upper half plane. Now I want to start applying this to the construction of a DLA. And to do that, I want to take a particular form of the map. The particular map I want to take is W is G of Z is Z plus 1 over Z. W is Z plus 1 over Z. It has as its inverse, when I solve the quadratic equation for Z, Z is W plus the square root of W squared minus 4 over 2. I call the mapping in this direction F, and the mapping in that direction G. If you look and see what happens, F takes you from, for example, the real axis to a piece which goes along this real axis, unit circle, real axis, the upper half of the unit circle, and because it's a conformal map, it takes the upper half plane into the region above the colored curve here. So this produces a bump. The strategy I'm going to follow is to describe the learner evolution as a succession of bumps piled one on top of the other. This is an alternative strategy to following the learner differential equation, which sort of gives line segments piled on top of one another in a continuous fashion. This piles bumps, and if you take two circles and pile them on top of one another, you get something that looks like that. Hastings and Levitov took lots and lots of bumps, here's one of them, and piled them on top of one another using conformal invariance. What they were trying to do is produce something which looked as much as possible like DLA. After several thousand bumps, they got something that looked like that, and that is, to anyone's eye, indistinguishable in its fractal properties from the DLA cluster. Now, I have to tell you about how they chose the position of the bumps and how they chose the size of the bumps. These are the two things you have to do in order to get a new bump on there. In the original DLA, as you recall, there was a random walker sent in from infinity. That random walker wandered around and found a place to land. That place to land was the place where the new bump was put. An equivalent procedure, which people could have done, people did do, was solve the Laplace equation with the source at infinity and the probability equal to zero on the aggregate. The probability for land is proportional to the normal gradient of the solution at the surface, and that is equivalent to the random walker story. So 1 and 2 are equivalent ways of finding whether a random walker should land. Equivalently, if you think of things in terms of electrostatics, which as you know I do, you solve an electrostatics problem with charge 1 on the aggregate and calculate a potential obeying Laplace's equation outside the aggregate. Once again, the gradient of the potential on the aggregate gives the probability of landing. That is, 1, 2, and 3 are exactly equivalent things. Another exactly equivalent thing is that you form the map G of W, taking the aggregate onto the unit circle, with the extra condition that G goes to W as W goes to infinity. You write log G as phi plus I psi. Phi is the potential, and that's equivalent to solving for the potential here. And once again, the gradient gives the probability of finding a particular place on the aggregate to put a bump. All four of these methods are identical. This method looks a lot like SLE type methods. 1, 2, and 3 look somewhat different. The reason, of course, that these things are identical is that the phi given in here is the same as the solution of the Laplace's equation given there, and the boundary conditions determine everything, and the boundary conditions are the same. Equally, using G, one could take the initial data. One could say that once one had G, G is a map from a mathematical region to the physical plane, and one would say the mathematical region in question involves a unit circle, and that you're mapping from the unit circle onto the physical plane, and you just take the charges distributed at random on the unit circle, and that's equivalent to all of the other methods of figuring out where the charges, where the bump should go. So in constructing DLA, we take, or they take, very many small bumps. You use G to describe the shape of the interface. You place the next bump randomly on the circle. That is, you put it on the mathematical plane, and you choose it to have a radius A. The map that is relevant is W plus 1 over W, but you choose it to be placed at X, and you choose it to have a radius, the bump to have a radius A, and this map will do that job. However, and the new map is the old map composed with this extra bump. That's fine. All of that works, but we have to figure out how big a bump we should make. The original DLA procedure was to choose the size of the bump equal so that all bumps had equal size in the physical plane. That is only one of many possibilities. You can do lots of things, and I think the next slide tells you first about what we're doing, and then about, I'm sorry, I got the notation backwards between the slides and my writing on the board. The radius of the bump is R according to this, and its position is A. Since we have a two-parameter family of maps, it doesn't matter so much what I call the parameters, but it's good to call them the same thing in both the slides and the blackboard, so that achieves that. And according to the slide, I should have a factor of 2 there. So we take a multiple iteration of such maps, and we end up with an entire mapping function. We take one bump and then pile many bumps on top of one another and try to carefully arrange the bumps to be all of the same size, and we get that. If we do that long enough and hard enough, we have 1,000 or 1,000,000 bumps, and we have something that looks just exactly like a DLA cluster. Okay, now we come to a crucial slowing down spot. We have two things that are slightly different. One is DLA, and the other is piling bumps on top of one another. They're not much different, but the DLA, it takes round things, and the process of iteration takes those round things and distorts them somewhat by a conformal map. I say here that this result done with the conformal mapping is almost certainly in the universality class of DLA. Now, I cheated a little bit. I, just before lunch, made a sort of long comment which started to talk about universality in problems of statistical physics. Let me continue that comment right now. Universality in statistical physics means that there are a variety of problems. There's this problem, that's the Ising model. This problem is called the three-state Potts model. This state is called percolation. This one is called the loop-erased random walk, and this one's called something else entirely. We have this discrete collection of problems. Over here, maybe, we have a whole line of problems, but that line of problems is described by one single parameter. Here we have discrete problems and then a line of problems. Now, what happens to the rest of the huge space in which we might define problems? Well, the rest of that space is irrelevant. That's a technical term meaning that in the asymptotics in which the lattice disappears, every single scale invariant feature is identical to all the other problems of that universality class. Identical, except perhaps for trivial things like a change in scale or a change in the, where the problem is put, that is, do we have our Ising model here or there, or a few other tiny details. The issue about, for example, the square versus the triangular versus the hexagonal percolation problem is an issue about whether or not they lie in the same universality class. And if you develop information about whether Cardy's formula holds equally well for all of those problems, you are developing information about whether they lie in the same universality class. And from the kinds of theory that exist around them, whether or not this collection of problems have identical other properties in the scaling limit. Nothing about what happens at the lattice scale can be universal, but anything a scale much larger than the lattice scale is expected to be universal. So, when I say DLA bumps appear at random positions in the physical plane and then define, that's work of Hastings and Levitov, and then define a problem, a model, which is almost certainly in the universality class of DLA, I am making extremely strong claims about the relation between those models. Those claims have not been proven even by the weak standard of proof of physics. It is possible, and no one of the physicists who work on these things will die of embarrassment if they actually turn out to be somewhat different. However, the situation is different on the other problems. The problems which I just listed for you, there exists extremely good evidence based most richly in conformal field theory. What's conformal field theory? Well, conformal field theory is a field theory developed by people like Schwinger and Dyson and Feynman carried out in the case of zero mass and carried out in this situation in two dimensions in which we know that there is a full, we believe that there's a full conformal invariance in the result. We're not at all sure about whether conformal invariance applies in any case, in any sense to DLA. In fact, we think that it does not. However, let's come back to the other problems. These other problems have a behavior which we believe is essentially identical, one problem to the next. The Ising model, for example, which is the one that is most studied of all of these, has a triangular and a square version. Explicit exact calculations have shown that many of the properties of these two models are identical. An argument based on renormalization group talks about all possible perturbations around the critical point of one or another of these problems. In talking about those perturbations around the critical point, they are divided into two classes. One class of perturbation is called relevant, and the other is called irrelevant. The relevant perturbation is the perturbation that makes a big difference, like setting the p-value for a percolation problem away from criticality. That makes a big difference. Critical is different from everything else. Irrelevant thing, which might perhaps be like the difference between a square lattice and a lattice that differs only by epsilon from being square, that is said to be an irrelevant perturbation and does not, in the renormalization group calculation, change the result of any of the critical properties, the critical indices, the zeta 4 and zeta 6 and so forth that we heard about. The analog of those indices do not change, nor do lots of other very important properties. Now, we are here in this place, as I'm told, in part because we know that the renormalization group ideas and the universality which springs from them works in one case which is proven, another case which is speculated, and we wonder about SLE. The case which is proven is, as I said before, a dynamical systems theory. The Feigenbaum fixed point or the fixed point of circle maps, many of the important results have been proven and the universality has been shown to be true. In statistical mechanics, well, it's good enough for physicists, but no mathematician would take it as a problem which is solved. In SLE, we have not, or you have not, since I hardly work in the field, I'm sort of on the fringe, we have not, if I might presume, begun to think about how to formulate the various perturbations which take us from one problem to another. Now, that's important, because if I'm standing here, I am the Ising model, around me is a set of problems, all of which have the same critical point as the Ising model. And if I'm the three-state POTS model, around me is a set of problems which have the same behavior as the three-state POTS model. These separated problems have a boundary between them in the appropriate space of couplings, and that boundary even is to some extent understood via work on the flows, renormalization group flows that Zamolodchikov has done. Well, that finishes my tirade on the subject. What more do I have to say? Well, we have a bunch of problems that fall in different universality classes. If the probability of having a bump come up is proportional to the gradient of the probability to this interface to a power eta, eta equals 1 is DLA. Other values of eta are different models. Each different value of eta gives you a different model. It is like this example which I talked about here, in which you have not isolated models, but a whole line of different models, here parameterized by eta. Eta equals 4 is called the dielectric breakdown model and is said to be rather special. Other models, like what is called noise-reduced DLA, are special in different ways. You might imagine varying the bump size. That might produce a new universality class. You might imagine putting on sizes of bumps which are inversely proportional to the electric field. That is not proportional to eta equals 1, but eta equals minus 1. That has a much better chance of being like some version of SLE. Hastings and Levitov investigated the case in which the bumps were separated. Rather, it was Hastings. I guess Levitov was not involved in that paper. Were separated in the math plane by a distance plus or minus kappa to the 1/2 power times epsilon, where epsilon, which is the radius of the bump. The random walk properties of produced by this, according to Hastings, were very similar to the SLE properties produced with the corresponding value of kappa. This is a speculation and a less checked speculation than most. This says that the collection of all DLA problems done in a particular way is the same as the collection of SLE sub kappa. So we are in a situation where we have three different areas of mathematics, math, physics, whatever you call it. One area involves phase transitions. Another involves SLEs and percolation and related problems. And a third involves having the dynamical systems problems that have qualitative changes in behavior. As I understand it, the organizers of this school wanted to focus on the similarities and differences, this set of workshops, excuse me, it's not a school. The organizers of this set of workshops wanted to focus on the similarities and differences on the three sets of problems. The successes, and there have been many major successes in all three areas, are different in the different areas. What one can do for the Ising model via the speculations that have to do with statistical physics is different from what one can do for the speculated connection between the Ising model and SLE. In fact, they almost don't overlap. There is the possibility, and I believe that's the possibility considered by the organizers, that all three areas can learn from each other if they would but listen. Thank you. My apologies. You have a proper proof of that, I assume, and for which I then apologize. The speculation appears maybe first, but speculation appears first to my eyes in Hastings. We don't read enough either. That means that there are separate and literatures for at least three separate areas. In fact, there is a fourth area. Computer scientists work on percolation on random lattices, and they, that's different. We don't talk to them either. It's bad. It's bad not to get credit, as I missed giving you credit, for which I apologize. That's a bad thing to do. And if we could listen better, we would give each other credit in a more proper fashion.
Some people actually in the late 80s have considered basically to try to have tried to study DLA by composing components, much like Hastings and Levinhoff did. And incidentally, even there's no paper written whatsoever that you have exactly studied that. And the only trace in the literature is one talk given by Richard Rothberg from Washington University in St. Louis. And they look exactly that you add bumps to it, they take slits, so you compose slits of one versus where it's like a fixed size. And actually, back then they realized already that this is, of course, in a sense of the Lerner equation with a random function which is piecewise continuous. And that part was actually titled stochastic Lerner evolution. And you should imagine that was 89, 10 years before that introduced. We get the talk title. It's a different S, so it's not the SLE. You know, even mathematicians did. And that's true. Yeah, it's a macaque part of them, of course. I mean, they have
when was like macaque stuff?
In the 90s.
Well, it is, of course, published in 2001.
No, I think
there is another problem which you people have talked around slightly. That is that a typical time to publication in the physics world is epsilon, and the typical time to publication in the math world is 1 over epsilon, and that makes it hard to give credit.